Hello, I'm Dr. Steven Stannis. On behalf of CME Outfitters, I'd like to welcome you and thank you for joining us for today's educational REMS activity titled Heeding the Call for Safe and Responsible Pain Management in Our Communities. This activity is brought to you by CME Outfitters, an award-winning, accredited provider of continuing education for clinicians across the globe. Today's webcast is the first in a series of Risk Evaluation and Mitigation Strategies, or REMS, education covering the FDA blueprint, Opioid Analgesic REMS Education Blueprint, for healthcare providers involved in the treatment and monitoring of patients with pain. REMS compliant education is a critical component of the Extended Release Long Acting Opioid Analgesic REMS program to provide education to clinicians on safe opioid practices, as well as current regulations and guidelines on treating pain and prescribing opioids appropriately. Watch your email for additional REMS compliant education from CME Outfitters. Our real goal for today's activity is to help you to safely and effectively improve the lives for our patients struggling with persistent pain. As I mentioned, I'm Steven Stannis. I'm the Medical Director of Swedish Health System Pain Medicine and Services in Seattle, Washington. I'm also the past president of the American Academy of Pain Medicine. First, I want to welcome Dr. Kevin Goepke. Dr. Goepke is the chair of the Department of Family Medicine at Indiana University School of Medicine in Indianapolis. Welcome, Kevin.
Thanks, Stephen. Glad to be here.
Good. And I also want to introduce Dr. Neil Skolnick. Dr. Skolnick is a professor of family and community medicine at the Sidney Kimmel Medical College of Thomas Jefferson University in Philadelphia. He's also the associate director of family medicine residency program at Abington Jefferson Health in Jenkinton, Pennsylvania. Welcome, Neil.
Steve, pleasure to be here as well.
So good. As you guys see, we've got the East Coast, the Midwest, and the Northwest covered. Whether you're a pain specialist like me or a family physician like my colleagues, it's likely that a good portion of your time is spent managing pain. But I wanted to first get your interest in how much of your week is devoted to pain management. So let's break this down and please put in your answers. Is it 1 to 20%, 21 to 40%, 41 to 60%, 61 to 80%, or 81 to 100% of your time treating patients with pain complaints? Kevin, Neil, what did you answer regards to your practice?
I changed my answer. So what happened was I was about to click on 1 to 20%. And then I thought, because that's what my sense was, just as I think most people did here. And then I said, wait a minute, actually, pain persists through a lot more of the visits than just the people who are coming in primarily for pain management. So I actually have two answers. One is those people who are coming in for specifically pain management, which might be 10, 15% of my patients. But then there's a whole nother pretty large group, I think a third of my patients, who are coming in as one of their list of concerns. You know, they're diabetes, hypertension, COPD, but they also have bad knee arthritis. And we'll often talk about what to do about that as well. So I think it depends how you view your management of pain. So it's not just primarily pain visits. That's my thoughts here.
Yeah, Kevin? Kevin?
Yeah, Stephen, it's not surprising that an academician would hedge his response there. So I'm going to give Neil kind of a hard time. But,
Thank you.
You know, when I looked at this, I thought exactly of the response that Neil mentioned. We have this continuity of care, this relationship-based care, and we know that our patients have many different chronic comorbidities, and not the least of which is their osteoarthritis that is limiting them in the things they want or need to do. So I really think it's probably in that 20 to 40% range of patients that I manage directly. I think that's a very fair assessment.
Yeah, and I agree. It's probably beyond just what their diagnosis would be that day or how you think of them globally. And on the pain management side, we see patients obviously with chronic pain complaints, but they may have multiple pain complaints in a given visit. So, okay. Well, that's good. Thanks. And we'll have some other polling questions later on. I now want to move on. Kevin, let's set the stage here for us about the extent and the impact of Americans living with chronic pain. And this will be a good setup for what we're going to talk about today with focusing on biopsychosocial assessments and really getting to better understand a patient-centered approach. I'll turn it over to Kevin.
Yeah, thanks, Stephen. Ultimately, I think across the board, regardless of what area of medicine you're practicing in, you're going to be called upon to assist in patient care that involves either direct care of chronic pain or really tailoring a care plan to someone who is going to have restrictions for chronic pain. When you look at this stat of 50 million Americans with the recognition that that's really one in seven Americans have chronic pain. And, you know, really, if 20 million patients have high impact chronic pain, you really get a sense for just how this affects our society. It's not just our elderly patients. It's really across the board. You can really see how people have a difficult time with managing other chronic diseases because we talk to them about losing weight, about being more active, unless you're in the midst of the COVID crisis where we're asking them to walk around their small apartment a lot more than but if people are limited in what they can do because of their chronic pain, it really not only impacts their ability to work and be productive in other areas, but to really follow through in some of the recommendations that we provide for them. You know, I think that leads right into the realm of education. And Neil, we've had a dialogue about education. I think now's a good time to revisit that.
Yeah, that's a really good point, Kevin. And I like your overview of how important it is and how many patients are affected by pain. And that makes me also think of when typically as a physician, when I think of education, it's to other physicians. And while clearly that's important, and that's why we're doing today's event, and we'll go over a lot of information, I think education equally, if not even more so, applies to patients. And this is true across disease states. So if we're going to have a goal of, for instance, de-escalating pain medicine or weaning a patient off of opioids or not beginning an opioid to begin with, that is really challenging if patients are hearing about these issues for the first time from us. It's the same in a lot of different areas. I think antibiotic stewardship is an area where we as family docs see this a lot. It used to be very difficult to tell a patient they didn't need an antibiotic for their cold-like symptoms, for their sinus symptoms. Now, it's very easy because the word is out there through a lot of education that we don't want to develop antibiotic resistance. We want to reserve those antibiotics for when they're needed later. The same thing is true now with opioids. And I had a very interesting interaction just a few weeks ago with a patient who came in asking actually for oxycodone, for Percocet, for their back pain. And I was like, this is not going to go well. It turned out it went really well. I asked her in detail. I took a detailed history. It turned out that she had a sister who had had an opioid abuse problem. She didn't put those two pieces together. When I was able to point out to her the risk that she would incur, even by a short course of opioids, she was like, boy, I didn't realize that. That's a good point. Let's try and stay away from those medicines. So when we talk about education, it's both about educating us and our colleagues about correct prescribing, thoughtful prescribing. And at the same time, there's the responsibility to educate the lay public about these issues so that when we convey our concerns, the uptake there is a comfortable one.
Yeah, and I'm glad, you know, Kevin brought up the importance about just the disease approach. I mean, it's going to be on the phone with two primary care providers because you're used to doing disease management. And from the pain perspective, we're trying to teach our colleagues, this is chronic disease management. So that's great. I think the other comment I would have is about the education part. It's definitely important to be educating all the stakeholders. But what I've seen, and in our clinic, we have pain boot camps where people are here 15 hours a week, physical therapy, psychology, a lot of different treatments. The education that we're giving patients is so much different than it was 5 and 10 years ago in teaching patients about how their nervous system is sensitized, you know, the pain gates, psych and depression and anxiety. And so it's interesting when people finish our treatment programs, that's the highest part of their treatment when they do their surveys is the education part. So we as clinicians, I think for a long time underestimated how much patients can learn. And when they learn those things, their compliance improves as well.
Steve, that's a great point. You know, we're burdened by what has been termed the curse of knowledge. We know so much, we assume other people know that. And I love your point that it's important to convey that knowledge.
Okay, so with that in mind, we're going to keep plugging along here. Let's jump into our first learning objective, apply knowledge of acute and chronic pain pathways and underlying mechanisms to clinical assessment and appropriate pain management. To kind of get things moving on the clinical side, I wanted to talk just briefly about pain. And so to set the table here, you know, we can think of normal pain. Normal pain is a survival mechanism. It's a warning sign. Nociception is how our body processes pain signals from the skin to the spinal cord to the brain. And then, you know, those receptors in the skin need high intensity stimuli to stimulate those receptors. So we have this system. And the question is, what are the complexities around that? So for a number of years, we've kind of broken pain down into two types: nociceptive pain and neuropathic pain. And in the middle was a third type described as mixed pain, and over time maybe described as central sensitization. Our thinking has changed, and I like to think of nociceptive pain as pain arising from actual or threatened damage to non-neural tissue. It's primarily when you activate a nociceptor in the periphery. And then neuropathic pain is pain arising from some type of damage across the nervous system, whether it's in the periphery or centrally. And the third group now, we're not really calling it mixed pain anymore, but what's termed nociplastic pain. A nociplastic pain arises from altered nociception, but that's despite no evidence of damage to the receptor. And so fibromyalgia, a lot of our central pain conditions actually fall under that. So with that background, I wanted to kind of turn it over to Neil and Kevin. First to Kevin. Kevin's going to explain neuropathic pain and the different types, and basing it on these kind of three mechanisms, or what we're describing as three chronic pain presentations. Kevin?
Absolutely. I think it's completely relevant that we have approached pain, in my opinion, backwards over the years. We have now worked hard, at least over the last decade, to clearly delineate the types of pain, better understanding what's the source of the pain, and ultimately trying to treat pain based on what that source is. When we look at neuropathic pain, we, as you can see, there are a number of relevant examples here. We think about pain that presents with numbness, tingling, burning, electric shock sensation. We talk to patients about dysesthesia and those abnormal sensations that maybe don't have a source that can be readily identified. Sometimes they can. Other times people have allodynia from what's typically a non-painful sensation creating pain. When we look across the board, I think at the basis of best understanding neuropathic pain is understanding those nerve pathways, and also understanding how we can help patients not only manage the pain through medicines and other pharmacologic interventions, but also helping them understand better the source of that pain. It really goes back to what we were just talking about with patient education. But, you know, in this case, I think our provider education lagged behind. So yeah, thinking about this in terms of the three different sources and the mixed pain, there's definitely an opportunity for continued education.
Okay, so and now actually we're going to now shift to Neil, and Neil's going to go over nociceptive pain, so that other mechanistic model that we want to kind of review.
Yeah, nociceptive pain is the easy one. Frankly, it's the one that we've known about since we were 4 years old and got kicked in the shins. There's a stimulus, there's a tissue injury, and from that, there's pain. Now, what I think becomes interesting, and Steve, you're going to talk about the nociplastic pain, is that the lines can be blurred. You know, a good example would be long-term arthritis pain or low back pain, where there's no question there is a stimulus. That stimulus is often intermittent, but the pain in many ways exceeds both in amount and time the direct stimulus to the pain. So I'll hand that back over to you with regard to nociceptive pain.
Now, thanks. And you bring up a good point. Even something like nociceptive pain, that input from the periphery chronically to the spinal cord in the brain causes sensitization and changes. So you're correct. A lot of these conditions, there's a lot of overlap, especially with something that we thought before was in the periphery, like nociceptive pain versus neuropathic pain. So thanks for that. Yeah. So with that, you know, we did want to just again go back and talk about nociceptive pain. So nociceptive pain, that arises from altered nociception, despite, again, no clear evidence of actual threatened tissue damage, causing the activation of those nociceptors. And so our example here is irritable bowel syndrome. Other pain conditions could be fibromyalgia, tension type pain, headaches, other central mediated types pains. And so with IBS, there's, you know, stress. There's, it's been described as this kind of brain gut disorder. There's infectious changes in the gut. There's changes in permeability and a cascade of events. It's been described as kind of intestinal hypersensitivity. But with these changes, those changes can include changes in localized edema, cytokine release. But again, just like our other chronic pain states, these changes in the periphery causes changes at the spinal cord and in the brain and leading to a sensitized state. So, you know, IBS, fibromyalgia, those we can describe as nociceptive pain. It's important, and we're really excited about these illustrations that we were just able to show you. Those pain pathways are very important and important to be educating your patients about. You can actually, we'll have access to these videos, which we'll go over later on in the discussion. So these, you know, three videos are nice examples of nociceptive, neuropathic, and nociceptive pain. So let's move on to our second learning objective. And this is going to include, upon evaluation of our current clinical workflows of opioid prescribing, we're going to go more into the clinical aspects of what we're doing day to day, incorporating two best practice strategies to optimize safe and competent prescribing and minimizing potential for abuse and diversion of medicine. Okay, so let's talk about treatment planning. I'm going to move to Kevin. Kevin, last spring, we know the HHS released its task force report. I think this was the highest ever at the government level, a comprehensive report looking at the gaps and inconsistencies and kind of needs to improve pain management across the spectrum from primary care all the way up to specialty care. As a starting point with that, can you talk about some of the things that we should be thinking about when we are developing a treatment plan for someone that's presenting in pain?
Yeah, thanks, Stephen. I think we have to remember that there is really no one size fits all approach for pain. Each of our patients is going to be very different. People who live with pain, they're suffering. They need a compassionate approach. They need to be, as we mentioned earlier, educated. But we also have to remove some of the misperceptions that people arrive at our office with. Neil mentioned his patient that came in with an assumption that she needed something, and with appropriate education, she was able to better understand how that approach should be evolved. Certainly, there is the pillar of medication, but restorative therapies, interventional procedures, behavioral health approaches, that's been a real challenge across our system, and we're working hard to close that gap, especially across our primary care entities, where we actually have embedded psychologists and embedded social workers to help people bridge those gaps, and being open-minded to complementary and integrative health as we go through that treatment approach. Certainly, the base of this is going to need to be founded on education. It's a big part of our responsibility to have a conversation with our patients, think about how we engage other members of our team, and really do a thorough risk assessment. I've recently been asked to do a review of a case, a malpractice case, where a provider was being accused of malpractice because he had given a patient opioid medications, and ultimately that patient had a history of addiction and abuse and hadn't disclosed it. So it's really a key piece to our risk assessment to make sure that that's incorporated into each of our evaluations.
Yeah, and actually, I think what's important too, and I like about you commenting on the HHS, the task force report, is this isn't a stepwise approach anymore. They included all five of those interventions is what we should be considering from the beginning, not you do medicines first, then consider this, then consider injections. But really, we need to be changing our thinking across these five disciplines, even from early on. So thanks. And so, Neil, let's look at part of the HHS task force also really focused on patient-centered care. So I wanted to see what your thoughts were around how do you do that? How do you approach this concept of patient-centered care with patients presenting with pain?
I think patient-centered care is an awareness, Kevin, as you just talked about, of the different modalities that are available. And Steve, as you just talked about, an awareness that it's not step care. This is different than asthma. This is talking to a patient about what their needs are and thinking about what we have to offer as a toolbox. In essence, we are a carpenter walking into a house. And if we're going to do drywall, we're not taking out a sledgehammer. No, we're deciding we're using that thing that you do drywall with. I don't know drywall. But the point is matching our tool, and we have a lot of things in our toolbox. We have, as Kevin went over, we have medicines, and we have lots of different medicines. We have interventional procedures that have different amounts of data supporting or suggesting they may or may not work. There's integrative treatments. I have been so thoroughly impressed clinically with two particular types of integrative therapies. One is acupuncture. We actually now have an acupuncture practicing physician, a family doc who did extra training in acupuncture in our office once every 2 weeks so that we can offer that service. I've also been impressed by the results of hypnosis. There's lots of integrative approaches that for a long time we didn't pay attention to until we realized our medicines don't work as well as we thought. They have a lot of side effects, and on the other side of that equation, a lot of the integrative approaches work better than we thought and have less side effects. So I think there's a lot of choices. And then also behavioral health interventions. There is robust data in the CBT literature on the benefits of CBT, both for helping diminish pain, but also for helping patients deal with the pain that most of our patients do under the best pain management plan. We don't get rid of pain. We hope to dampen it. And then the question is, how do people function given the amount of pain that they have? Steve?
Yeah, I know. I'm glad you're talking about this at the primary care level, because we're doing it at the tertiary in a pain center. We have an addiction specialist in our clinic who uses acupuncture to help kind of maintain his patients that are treated for opioid use disorder. So he has a very busy acupuncture practice with his, regular follow-ups for his pain patients and opioid use disorder patients. And also we use a lot of relaxation training with the relaxation therapist that's teaching patients how to calm their nervous system down. So, I always think, why do we wait till they're in a chronic pain clinic to teach them these techniques? So it's really good to hear that understanding at the primary care level as well. So, with that, Neil, I wanted to move on because the last part of the HHS task force really focused on biopsychosocial approach. And we all know that's important. I wanted to just get your thoughts about that, because that's also something we're really going to need to get the word out to providers to be thinking about that early on.
Yeah, and I think here, and this is not news to us as primary care docs. This is what we are about every single day. So as you see on the slide, there's biologic factors, psychological factors, and social factors. To me, what this means is we need to take a careful history, and we need to pay attention to domains of function. So there's physical, there's psychological, there's social. For many of our patients, spiritual is a domain of function that's very important to them and a source of strength. Another way I view domains is work, home life, and who we are as a person. How do we feel about ourselves? And if we're not thinking about those different areas and we're just jumping to say, you have back pain, here's some medicine, there become two problems. One, we're not treating their pain as effectively as we could, but we're also then not following the things that we need to look at. What are our metrics of results? How is someone's home life? Are they now, I have a patient, a success that I'm thinking about is someone who used to sit around not doing much. I was seeing him and his wife, and after appropriate addressing across domains, and it included medicine, it was so gratifying to hear him come in and describe how the weekend before he helped paint his kitchen. So that would be an area where he's re-entering, and eventually he started going back to work. So I think there's a lot of this. The other thing is when we think about biologic factors, low back pain often is not just low back pain. If we're not addressing depression, we're not going to fully address pain. And if we think about low back pain, in fact, if we're not addressing weight management as a part of our plan to address low back pain, we're not doing optimal care. Back to you, Steve.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. And actually, you know, talking about that, and it kind of sets up the last part, because we're going to start really getting into more of the tools that people can use in their practice. I wanted to turn over to Kevin talking about risk assessment, and you talked about biopsychosocial. That risk assessment involves that whole domain. So I wanted to see what Kevin's thoughts are about that, and how what kind of tools he likes to use in his practice.
Absolutely. You know, once again, Neil and I are thinking along the same lines, and he was mentioning many of the thoughts that we take into our practice and into patient rooms when we're visiting with them. Really looking at that history, understanding everything about the social context of a patient's existence, understanding the kind of work they do, how they're doing psychologically, how they manage sleep and stress, having a better understanding of their past medical and psychiatric history can really give us a lot of information. The physical exam, the diagnostic screening, whether it be testing or the screening tools to assess for likelihood of abuse, you know, that all has to be part of our risk assessment. We also have to make sure that we have a delineated diagnosis. That's part of this as well. Many times people have an unclear or a diagnosis that they've carried forward that hasn't been completely worked up over time. Ultimately, we know that people who have a history of abuse and addiction, people who have depression and anxiety, people who aren't functioning well to start with, they're going to be higher risk for some of the treatment options, including opioid therapy and other medication modalities.
Yeah, so we actually did want to touch upon those different tools, and a lot of the work more recently has been around assessing for risk for misuse of opioids or risk for aberrant behaviors. Besides those tools, I also wanted to see what other tools do you like to use for looking at depression and anxiety? Neil?
Well, for depression and anxiety, I think the PHQ-9 is excellent, both for helping with diagnosis, and I'll come back to that in a moment, but also following people over time. The GAD-7, also excellent for anxiety. Now, where I would say, and I'll go out on a limb here, and I'll be interested, Kevin, in your thoughts and Steve, yours. I find the tools for assessing depression and anxiety very helpful, because I can get a number and I can know where I am at the start of treatment, and then I can follow that over time in a way that I cannot do as precisely when I just look at my note that says something like, you know, was very depressed or kind of depressed. This gives us a number to assess the results of treatment over time. When we talk about, and on the slide here, the last one mentioned is the opioid risk tool. While there's a real movement toward using validated tools across disease states, now in primary care, we hear when we talk about asthma, we talk about the asthma control test. When we talk about COPD, we talk about the MMRC. And my sense in talking to a lot of my colleagues is that people find it hard to integrate a lot of these validated tools. And for instance, and I'm going to put it a little bit of a challenge here. For instance, for the opioid risk tool, the other day I looked up its sensitivity and specificity. And while there's a lot of studies out there, it comes out with the sensitivity for detecting opioid risk of about 70 to 80% same on specificity, which I'll say in that good. And I'm not convinced that's better than a careful history. Now, where these validated tools do a much better job than we do clinically is they remind us to take a careful systematic history, so that they do a lot better than when you forget to take a history, which happens a lot in busy practices. So if that's what you need as a prompt, then they serve a fantastic function. I'm just not convinced if you are systematic and you're taking a good history at the start and periodically through treating your patients who you're considering or who are using opioids, that the tools do substantially better than that careful clinical approach. Again, very interested in your thoughts.
Yeah, and actually I would ask Kevin if you want to spend a couple seconds to go through and explain the opioid risk tool in case some people aren't familiar with that or haven't used it in the past.
Absolutely. I would just start by adding to Neil's comments that, you know, we all have a workflow and we've tried to be a little more prescriptive around our workflow in pain management, especially in our patients who are on chronic opioid therapy. It's actually part of the information that we gather for every single patient that comes through the door for PHQ-9. You know, essentially we ask a PHQ-2 and it triggers the full 9 depending on what they answer. We've built into our electronic medical record a template for those chronic opioid therapy patients when they're coming back in, so that we utilize the SOAP and the COM and really look at function. The opioid risk tool, you'll notice, is up on the screen. Essentially, it screens based on a family history of substance abuse, a personal history of substance abuse, the patient's current age. Is there any history of sexual abuse during childhood? And ultimately, it gives a lot of information that you might not have otherwise gathered, especially the pre-adolescent sexual abuse. We don't commonly ask about that. People don't tend to bring it up as part of a routine history. So it is an effective tool to bring into what you're doing. But once again, it is just one piece of information. It's a tool that we can employ in the greater realm.
Yeah, and I'll comment. The opioid risk tool, and actually in the state of Washington, it's mandated now for subacute pain and chronic pain that you use some validated tool to risk stratify patients. So we by law have to stratify all of our patients, and we stratify them low, medium, and high. We use the opioid risk tool, and then we actually have it built into our electronic medical record. So once a year or every 6 months, patients fill out their ORT, the MA puts it through, it's in our electronic medical record, and we can see that in flow sheets moving forward. And we also use PEG. Our state has mandated that you have to ask and have some validated tool for function. So we use PEG across all of our primary care clinics. But I understand the challenges because primary care has a lot of other things that are doing. And how do you get that into the workflow so it's something that can be done? You can access the information easily and it doesn't slow you down. But I've been really impressed with not more the sensitivity and specificity of ORT, but just asking the question. I had a patient last week in her late 70s. She'd had multiple surgeries, multiple hip joint replacements. She started crying when we started talking to her about treatment recommendations. And she said, you know, fill out those questions today and no one ever asked me about sexual abuse. And I actually had been abused by my stepfather, you know, 60 years ago. And I always wondered how that impacted all of the issues in my life. So it was actually more of like an opening to get her to talk about something she really had never really discussed with anyone before. So, a lot of these tools are tools. They're screening tools, so we can use those to start the discussion. But hopefully they're easy to integrate into your practice, so they don't slow you down, and then they become kind of a barrier for providers when they're looking at treating patients. Okay, so thanks for your comments. I actually wanted to go back to Neil to go over some of the pharmacologic options for pain management. Again, as we kind of narrow this down to focusing more on the clinical aspects of what we're doing, seeing patients. Neil?
Thanks, Steve. So we've talked about the general issues, and often visits do have an important part of them where we decide What medicine should we use? And we have lots of choices now. And I'll go over these briefly. So, acetaminophen, we're all familiar with, very easy to use, not much risk. If you use too much, fit liver issues, be careful. We didn't used to think it affected anticoagulation or warfarin. It does. There's an interaction there. NSAIDs, I'm going to come back and spend a little bit more time on, but the critical thing with NSAIDs, and my sense is that even though the data has been around for at least 15 years, it is underappreciated, is we're all familiar with the GI bleed risk of NSAIDs. I think most of us are familiar with the renal issues. I've been impressed that the issue around increased cardiovascular risk with NSAIDs is not as well appreciated. It is in the product insert as a boxed warning, and it's been, and that issue has been around for at least 15 years now, and it isn't trivial. And very briefly, if we look at relative risk, we see a relative risk of cardiovascular outcomes, meaning MI, stroke, sudden death due to cardiovascular disease, of about 1.4 or 40% increase in cardiovascular risk with use of NSAIDs, and so which essentially means be very, very careful if someone has a history of an MI, has a history of existing coronary disease, or is at very high risk. So I think that's an important thing to recognize. Let's now go on to anticonvulsants like gabapentin. Again, usually well tolerated, though you get a significant amount of people do get tired on them. Antidepressants, TCAs, SNRIs, duloxetine being an example, I think are wonderful choices, and all with side effects that we're aware of. Duloxetine, much less side effects than TCAs, which are often hard to use because of their anticholinergic side effects, particularly in the elderly. Some musculoskeletal agents, anxiolytics, I don't usually think of as specifically for pain, though they can be helpful. It's clearly helpful to address as an adjunct to our pain management. And then opioids, which we're very aware of. And the main issue, of course, with opioids is the potential for opioid addiction, which is why we want to be very, very careful, both with acute and chronic use, because more than 3 days of use, if someone started on an opioid analgesic, after 3 days, if you look out a year, 6% of people who are started on an opioid are still on chronic opioids a year later. So we really want to be very careful at that first step in that cascade of pain management. Steve?
Yeah, and I would comment too, I think what I see more when patients present to us later on is maybe the opioid was, you know, the clinician put all their eggs in one basket. It was just opioids. And, you know, any of these medicines, the analgesic effect may be 1 or 2 points on a 10-point scale. And, you know, maybe everyone thought that was going to be the sellout. That was going to be the victory, right? And not using antidepressants correctly and not, you know, looking at medicines for sleep, you know, really the different types of medicines that you showed there, they all have different mechanisms of action, and they're all focusing on different mechanisms across the whole nervous system that's affected. So you're correct. And that actually sets up our next slide, where we wanted to go over some of the information around using multimodal treatment. You know, in the past, there was a lot of focus on opioids. We thought of those as really powerful analgesics. And I think we didn't appreciate how multimodal analgesia, or what I call rational polypharmacy, could work. So do you want to comment on this study that looked at perioperative pain and the use of NSAIDs, Neil?
Yeah, and I think we've really had our eyes opened, and it's a nice reminder of how important it is for us as physicians to be critical consumers of medical information. Because back 10, 15 years ago, the whole pain is the fifth vital sign, and we felt we had to treat everyone's pain, and we scored it. And if there wasn't perfect treatment of pain, we had increased therapy. And so therefore we thought that opioids had no ceiling. Well, what happened? We weren't looking. There wasn't good data on chronic treatment with opioids. There wasn't even great data outside of tooth extraction studies on how well opioids worked. And we forgot something that, I think we're most informed from people who study Zen Buddhism, which is suffering is a part of life. Now, I'm not a fan of pain, but I think it informs us that idea back years ago that we could have a scale and get rid of all pain was a misconstrued idea, and we never looked at that critically. Now we move ahead to our current time, and we're looking at evidence, and this slide is a wonderful example. Oxycodone, which we thought of as fantastic for pain, well, actually doesn't do as well in randomized studies as naproxen. And what's amazing, if we look at the last column here, simple old ibuprofen plus some acetaminophen does best of all of the medicines, has the lowest number of needed to treat for 50% pain relief. So sometimes simple is better. What does that mean? Well, I think to me what it means is that we need to pay attention to two things. One, this slide addresses efficacy, and efficacy isn't as good as we used to think, and it's actually better for some of the easy-to-use medicines than we used to think. But the other thing, since efficacy isn't that great, and Steve, you alluded to this, we really need to pay attention to safety. And this is where that individualized approach, you know, a 25-year-old with pain, we should almost never use an opioid because the risk of opioid addiction is very high. On the other hand, an 80-year-old with a history of hypertension and diabetes, and if you put this through the NHLBI cardiovascular risk calculator, that 80-year-old with hypertension, diabetes, and high cholesterol has better than a 50% 10-year risk of coronary artery disease, that person probably shouldn't be prescribed an NSAID. They probably ought to be prescribed an opioid instead of an NSAID. So we really want to individually risk stratify and then talk to our patients about what we feel would be, along with their input, shared decision-making, the best way to proceed. Steve?
Yeah, and I'm looking at that slide. I know within our own hospital system, you know, just teaching patients more about the expectations of pain right after surgery. You're going to have pain for 1 or 2 days. These are some other comfort measures you can do. Just that education, we've been able to see a significant reduction in the amount of opioids they ask for. So I don't think we're throwing the baby out with the bathwater, but, you know, can they use opioids for a short period of time, giving them 2 or 3 days supply versus 30 days, and they don't use the medicines anyways, and other problems happen related to that. And then how do we do, you know, scheduled higher dose NSAIDs in the perioperative period when it's appropriate to help decrease the inflammation? So, you know, I know in our own system, we've seen a significant reduction in opioid prescribing and an improvement in the pain treatment just because we're using those other adjuvants better. And so I think that's obviously key. And it actually sets up our next slide. I want to turn it back over to Kevin. You know, the CDC guidelines have been out now for 4 years, and there's been a lot about that. We could spend significant time on that. We want to touch upon it here. I wanted to turn over to Kevin to talk about, in general, what those 12 recommendations are about and how that impacted his practice and what are the kind of consequences of those guidelines. Kevin?
Absolutely. I'm still overwhelmingly impressed that Neil was able to work Zen Buddhism in his time. You know, the CDC guidelines were an amazingly powerful tool. Obviously, people look to the CDC and trust those recommendations. And it really gave people the opportunity to say, yes, opioids are not the first line of treatment for chronic pain. And really that there should be some limits on the amount of opioid utilization and the dosing that people were getting. The most valuable thing I think in our practices has been the ability to say, you know, with our state first emergency law, our emergency rule, and now the state law, that when patients come in, we can have those conversations around opioid prescribing. We can talk to them about the prescription management program so that we can monitor what people are getting filled. And at the end of the day, not only are patients being evaluated on that, but so are providers. This, I think, opened the eyes for many people in our healthcare system and around the country. So it's been an amazingly effective tool. What it did create, I think, is some unintended consequences. There is no quick writing of a large ship, and ultimately what I personally saw in our system is I took it upon myself to travel around to each of our 18 hospitals and give lunch and learns and talk to physicians and advanced practice providers about the new state requirements. And people were really upset about it. The biggest complaint, and it goes back to what we talked about earlier, was they don't have time to fill out the paperwork, to put people on contracts and essentially educate their patients. This was the easy button, give opioids and move on. Well, what that led to is many providers just saying, okay, I won't prescribe them at all anymore. And, you know, then we ran into patient abandonment problems and potentially patients who probably should have not been on opioids being abandoned and not being weaned in a proper manner. So certainly the guidelines that were set forth by state rules and ultimately laws have led to some of those unintended consequences. But I think the larger setting is that we now have a higher level of consciousness about the problem. I know my surgical colleagues have been mortified by the data that's come out with regards to the number of patients that become addicted just from the short course of post-operative opioids that they've been prescribed. So there's a lot here to talk about. We could certainly dedicate an entire hour just to this component.
Yeah, you're right. And I think, you know, the guideline was very rational. And unfortunately, there were those unintended consequences where they misinterpreted the guideline. And I think we quote Deb Dow's article that came out last year, that she was the main author on the CDC guideline, where there were cautionary dosage thresholds, and those thresholds were turned into hard stops, which were not the intention of the guideline. So I think there was this kind of getting this back to the pendulum, back to the middle, like what's appropriate, because we had some patients that were appropriately managed being force weaned and that leading to overdoses and to other issues, making them unstable, and then balancing the other side. So, you know, hopefully now we're in a better place. We know prescribing is going down. And, you know, how do we get that balance and keeping patients that are appropriate on this medicine versus avoiding kind of unnecessary dose escalation and the other things? Thanks. And I guess, Kevin, do you have any other comments or Neil about the guideline?
No, not really. I do think it created not as many problems as it solved, Kevin, as you alluded to. But boy, when you start having insurance companies telling you what you can prescribe, or state legislatures, which were very common, telling you what is appropriate to do in the office, you can anticipate their problems. So I think that the guideline had many good parts. It was well-intentioned, and then it kind of, fortunately, the pendulum has swung back toward an intelligent, nuanced approach.
Yeah, to all of us as providers, we should be aware of the guideline, what they actually say. And, you know, hopefully we'll start to see, because we're still seeing insurance companies sending us from the PBMs information that's clearly not accurate about dose reductions and things like that, which leads to ongoing frustration. So with that, actually, we want to keep moving through here. I really appreciate the discussion so far. We wanted to move to talk about what's happening around COVID, because we know that all of us have been living that. You know, Kevin, in your system, how has pain management been affected by COVID, and what have you guys been doing?
Well, I think the first challenge that we've been faced with is the previously referenced state law of having to see patients in person every 4 months if they are on a chronic opioid therapy treatment program and have a contract in place. We've been working closely with the state legislature to essentially get at least a temporary approval for virtual visits to count. Certainly, we shouldn't be having this cohort of patients come in and it being exposed or exposing others unnecessarily, just the same as we have approached the other chronic disease patients.
Yeah, I'll echo that. I think there's, in our practice, we've seen two areas of challenge. And we've gotten our legal advice that we can, at least in our state, we're able to do refills of opioid medicines solely using telehealth. And that's been important because our two areas of challenge are, one are the patients who we're seeing regularly within our practice, who we are the primary ones who are prescribing opioids. That's more comfortable. But we have another cohort of patients who are being co-managed or being seen by pain specialists, and not within our system, but not all of our patients stay within our system. One of the local pain management offices stopped seeing patients in the last 2 weeks. Their staff stopped showing up. And so we're left with making what are sometimes very challenging decisions. They are our patients. We know them, but we haven't been prescribing. Again, fortunately, the counsel that we've gotten, the legal counsel, has been we can use telehealth. So that's what we've been doing and making similar judgments to what we would make in the office.
Yeah, and it's good. And same in our system. I work for a large Catholic hospital system, and we've been doing phone visits. And now next week, we're going to start virtual visits with patients. Fortunately, we have a e-prescribing, which was initiated about 3 or 4 months ago, and that's been a lot easier. Obviously, we're not able to do urine screens and the typical monitoring that we were doing before, so we're just documenting that. Our state insurance lead commissioner actually passed an order that patients can get a one-time early refill through May 4th in our state. So that's opened it up, and that was mandated to all the payers that they have to support that. So we're just trying to avoid patients with opioid use disorder, patients with chronic pain, not being stuck without medicines and that leading to other problems, and treating them so they don't end up in the emergency room, where obviously we know our emergency room and hospital systems are overloaded with other patients. On the other side, for pain, it's been exciting for us here in Seattle. We have pain rehab boot camps already, but we're actually going to be rolling out virtual pain rehab programs with relaxation training, behavioral health, mindfulness, physical therapy, which is a little different, trying to do physical therapy through a virtual visit. And then we're doing a lot of recordings for our healthcare providers on mindfulness and deep breathing, so during the day they can de-stress. So we're doing a lot on the virtual rehab side for patient care delivery, but then on the other side, using those same resources to help our healthcare system and our healthcare workers that are really stressed out. And so I guess like many of you, we've been busy here kind of making that big shift. Okay, so again, we're going to keep moving here. Neil, we're going to talk about opioid tapering. We wanted to get your thoughts and kind of a general overview of that approach. And I think we included the HHS task force recommendations on tapering. Neil?
Yeah, and I think that's it's a critical area. And when we talk about opioid tapering, I want to be careful to, and weaning, I want to be careful to think up front about not everyone should be tapered or weaned. So really, when we think about what to do, the right first step is really what should we do? The second step is going to be establishing with the patient a partnership to move in the right direction. You know, in essence, what do we want to think about? Well, there's obvious times when we need to wean down our opioids. If someone's had an overdose, if they're not listening, if they're not adhering to their medicines, if they're coming into for too frequent refills, if they're also on multiple high-risk medicines, the most common example are benzos along with their opioids. We want to think about which to wean first. It's going to depend on the person, but those are not good medicines to both continue for most patients at the same time. So that's one bucket of why. The other group would be people who really their pain just isn't being greatly managed on the opioids. So why be exposed to the risk if you're not getting the benefit? If you're having adverse events, just you're very tired, some cognitive impairment, constipation, or if you're at very high doses where we know that the risk is greater of adverse effects. So those are the things we want to think about first. And I think in our discussion with our patients, this concept of the why behind the what is very important. Most of us can do what we want to do if we understand why we need to do it, but we got to be very careful not to jump to here's what you need to do. So that idea of the why behind the what. And so it really is a discussion with patients and seeing if they're ready. The stages of readiness, which we're familiar with in a lot of areas, is also important. Hey, you know, the first time you bring up, maybe we should think about weaning. If the patient says no, that's not the time to say, well, here's what we're going to do. We're going to cut your dose by no. This can take a few visits in order to bring everyone into the game plan, and our likelihood of success is much greater if it's made, if our decisions are made through a model of shared decision making and partnering with our patients. I'm not going to spend time talking about patients who truly have opioid use disorders. It's an important group to be aware of. They probably, we can try just weaning first, but they often will need some medicine-assisted therapy. And then the other thought, and this is true in primary care, I suspect it's also true in specialty practices, is none of us do it alone. Most things in life, right? We have the people that support us. And the same is true when we're talking about embarking on difficult endeavors like weaning opioids. I'll often ask someone to come in with their significant other. That significant other often wants to encourage them to wean down on opioids and can be very helpful in that process. And finally, you know, seeing what a patient's fears are as we're going to move ahead. What are you afraid of? Well, often it's, I'm going to be in a lot more pain, and we'll do our best to do this slowly and make sure there's a process where we minimize whatever it is you're afraid of. Is it depression, anxiety, pain, et cetera? Steve?
Kevin, do you have any comments? That was great.
I would just add, we're showing a sample opioid tapering flowchart, and there are many resources available like this. I would just remind folks to use your team. Our PharmDs help us amazingly as we work through this process, not just with identifying the best tapering program for those that we agree are going to benefit from reducing opioids or a combination of opioids and benzos, but also that educational piece. The physicians don't always have the time to spend, and you know, I think that really answers part of our question, is figure out how to build your team so that the team can be maximally engaged.
Yeah, and I like what both of you said. I think the HHS document is really good. It has some nice information on not just different ways and speeds you could do a taper, but setting up, you know, using motivational interviewing, getting patients more stabilized. They also have a nice discussion of how to diagnose opioid use disorder and some other things. So it's a short document, but I think it was well done, and it's got some good resources. You know, I like what Neil said about the why behind the what. You know, in our clinic, and it's fortunately in the state of Washington, they really focus with our new pain rules on, actually, we now have a rule that physicians have 3 months to do nothing when they get a new patient on opioids, because we want physicians to establish a good relationship, start to understand what's going on with the patient, and then consider, do you need to taper? And so that's been good. And I think in our own clinic, what we've learned is many times we hold the taper until patients are learning other techniques. If a patient has anxiety and poor coping strategies, just start decreasing their medicine, you're going to have a lot of problems. So we start to identify what are the issues we're going to help patients with, and then start the taper as they learn those other skills. So yeah, it definitely needs to be done in you know, a shared decision-making model, like Neil mentioned. Okay, so we're going to keep kind of getting through to the next slide here. We have another question for the audience.
I might just observe that people may not actually prescribe patients in or opioids at that high of a dose. That may be why they answered never. A challenge with the question.
You bring up a good point. In our clinics, and I'm sorry, across our primary care clinics, I think the average dose is, you know, in 70 to 80% of patients is less than 20 MEEs. So, Neil, sorry.
I'll also suggest there's a quote I've always liked from Samuel Johnson that said people often need to be reminded more than taught. And I think that part of the answer here is that we're not in primary care using those high doses. I don't think that's all of the answer. I think even, and I'm not going to say it's new to us prescribing naloxone, but the emphasis on this is relatively new to this. And it is, when you're busy, it's hard to remember even simple things if it's not what you're used to doing. So I think this, the importance of looking at the answers here is that reminder to everyone to think about naloxone and make a decision not to prescribe it rather than move ahead simply not thinking about it.
Yeah, and it's, you know, naloxone, there's been a significant reduction in overdose deaths. I think we learned from the CDC data just in 2018, deaths from overdose decreased by 4%. That's overdose from opioids. And I think within that group from the 2018 numbers, synthetic opioids continue to increase. So a lot of naloxone is even more important in the field with healthcare providers or police officers to reverse that. I think in our own state of Washington, they had 2,000 reversals last year alone, just in the field, in the community using naloxone. But with the other overdose death data, you know, heroin is increasing. Prescription opioids were only 27% of the overdose deaths, which is decreasing. It's still significant. But really, I think using naloxone out in the community and obviously figuring out when it's appropriate for patients. And really what we'd like to do in our system is who are the high-risk patients? Patients, not just their morphine equivalent, but other respiratory problems, COPD, or if they get sick, they're going to need naloxone in case they unfortunately have an overdose. It was interesting when they looked at the data, some of the high dose prescribing in the new starts were decreasing with regards to opioids. But a lot of the prescribing there was of naloxone varied in some of the rural areas was far less per prescription versus in larger cities. So there's still, I think, a disconnect, you know, identifying who those patients are that would benefit from naloxone. And then from a community standpoint, getting naloxone out there for everyone, not just getting a prescription through a physician or through a prescription. So with that, I'm going to turn it back to Kevin. We wanted Kevin to talk about risk factors for overdose, and then we'll get into the final questions. Kevin?
Absolutely. Thanks, Stephen. What I think we might want to add to that previous dialogue is as we develop those relationships with our patients, we get to know what their social network is, understanding their family situations. We take care of families that have persons with addiction that visit them, that live in the same home. Just within the past week, I had an Uber driver tell me that at some point over the last year, someone had overdosed in his car and he was really rethinking about whether or not he wanted to continue with that adjunctive employment. So really thinking about who we can proactively provide the rescue medications with. You know, I don't think we necessarily need to spend a lot of time on this slide. We yeah. touched upon the fact that people with substance use disorders and people who have co-prescribed benzodiazepines are the people that are really at high risk for overdose. Not only overdose, but people who are co-prescribed benzos and opioids are at higher risk for suicide. They have worse treatment outcomes and increased health service utilization. Those are the patients that we see utilizing the emergency departments and coming into multiple different physician offices trying to continue moving that forward. You know, as we look at ways to minimize the opioid and benzodiazepine co-prescribing, one of the questions that's come through is, what do I do with a patient that I've inherited that has been on both of these medications for a long period of time? And we've all seen that it's a very challenging situation. Many times they're being prescribed benzodiazepine by their psychiatrist. They're being prescribed the opioid by either a primary care physician or a pain physician. And the biggest piece to that is looking for opportunities to reduce those doses, to taper when and if possible. And, you know, going back to the previous conversation, making sure that people who are in these high-risk categories have naloxone available, that their family has it available, so that if they do overdose, that there is an opportunity for reversal there.
Okay, well, we're actually getting a lot of questions. So I want to maybe go through this last part a little quicker with our guests here, and then we can get to the questions and have about maybe 10, 15 minutes to respond to those. So Our final learning objective, how do we educate patients about their pain and to optimize safe and effective multimodal treatment? So with that, we have our final question. So Neil, if you want to go through the last part here, the last couple of slides on low health literacy and related to opioid misuse, and we'll get some comments from Kevin, and then we'll get to the questions.
Sure, and I'll take this relatively briefly because I suspect we're going to have some really good questions. And I think one of the keys with regard to education, at least in primary care, is recognizing that you don't have to do it all at this visit. So small amounts of information frequently, and these are patients that you're seeing fairly often. So there's the opportunity, and we remember things best when we're told different versions of it repeatedly over time. And at the same time, referring people if they're interested in larger amounts of information, there are a lot of online resources. So I'll put it back to you, Steve.
Okay. And then we actually wanted to go to Kevin about education about safe storage and disposal of medicines, which is important, and that could vary from state to state. Kevin?
Absolutely. So the slide, I think, gives a good breakdown of some resources that people can look into. What I do talk to patients about is if you're going to throw it away, separate the pills from the bottle, get rid of any personal information on the bottle when you do dispose of the bottle, and mix it in with something people aren't going to dig through. At my house, considering we have a cat that lives in the house, mixing it in with the cat litter is probably a good approach, but there are a number of different ways to go about doing that.
And you can go to the FDA websites about which medicines you can flush, and you're really trying to keep unused medicines away from, you know, medicine cabinets, and so they don't get in the hands of people with, you know, substance abuse disorders or even recreational users. So really important a discussion in the past I don't think a lot of us really thought of. Okay, so we're going to move on to kind of recap today's discussion. We phased this around SMART goals, you know, goals that are specific, measurable, attainable, and relevant. We talked about, you know, when creating a multimodal plan, align treatment choice, remember, you know, the different types. We talked about nociceptive, neuropathic, nociplastic pain, thinking about the underlying mechanism, and then how do you shape that with looking at a biopsychosocial approach with patients. For patients with chronic pain that are on long-term opioids, how do you do tapering? How do you do risk stratification? You know, looking at this patients in a patient-centered way. I think Neil touched upon that and how important that is. And also looked at, just briefly went through the opioid risk tool. We talked about some of the other tools you can use for anxiety and depression. And again, really looking at a biopsychosocial approach with the patients that you're going to be seeing. And I think most importantly, our last bullet there was really making the patients the partner, and really this being a two-way street, that the patient becomes that active participant in their care, whether it's teaching them other techniques to manage stress, going to physical therapy, using their medications appropriately. You know, it does need to be a more active role that the patient takes. But you as a clinician, too, obviously have to change maybe the way how you've approached patients in the past. So with that, I actually want to thank Kevin and Neil, before we get to the questions, for a great discussion. We're going to go through some of the takeaways like we did. I encourage everyone to visit the Opioid Education Hub on www.cmeoutfitters.com/RX for pain for a comprehensive list of additional clinical resources you can use. Remember, we showed those really interesting animations for nociceptive, neuropathic, and nociplastic pain. You can download those. You can show those to patients. I think those will be, you know, additional tools you can use to really change the dialogue you have with your patients. So one of the questions we have here came up about, can a phone call be enough, can be a tool for telemedicine? What codes are you using? More of a practical question for phone visits, what we call telephonic visits versus virtual visits. Kevin?
Yeah, absolutely. We are mostly out of necessity utilizing some of the telephonic visit codes. I don't have them in front of me now, but based on the amount of time that you spend on the phone with the patient, it can be coded that way. Basically, that's a response to not having everyone across our healthcare system up on our virtual platform to do video visits. So we've been able to integrate that. Another way that people can look at this is an extension of that team, and we've talked about it multiple times, but trying to best utilize your team. If you're not able to reach all of the patients that are calling in and were scheduled, empower your team members to do those phone calls for you as well.
Another question came up. Is there a clear FDA statement or study prohibiting the use of benzodiazepines?
I'll say I'm not aware of anything that says it's prohibited, but there are plenty of observational trials that show the combination is very dangerous. And I think that, so therefore, it's in a lot of the guidelines that it's something that we should be trying to avoid wherever possible in truth. And again, there are patients that are exceptions to every rule. I know that. But in general, benzos are not great long-term anxiolytics for most patients, separate from the issue of in combined with opioids, right? We ought to be using SSRIs. We ought to be using CBT as a wonderfully effective method at addressing anxiety. So when you're looking at a combination where there's a much elevated risk of mortality, those are individuals we should look at very carefully. Now, again, we all know as clinicians, people who are suffering from anxiety disorders are also typically worried about stopping one of their medicines if they're doing well on it. These are not quick discussions. These aren't the discussions that fall into the 5 to 10 minute category that we saw most of us indicated about education. These are the discussions that for me, I'll have initially, and then I may ask someone to come back if they want with a significant other, if not just them, and sometimes put aside 2 15-minute visits because we're going to need to sit down and really talk about this.
Yeah, and I guess I would comment too, in our state rules and best practices around benzodiazepines is we have to assess if a patient's on benzodiazepines, and actually it also includes other sedative medications, a lot of the Z drugs for sleep. You have to have a risk-benefit discussion. Many of our patients may be on low-dose benzodiazepines for sleep for many years. Can you use another agent? Can you introduce sleep hygiene techniques, cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia, and then try to reduce the benzodiazepine that it may be taking for night, versus a patient on benzodiazepines that's managed by a psychiatrist, coordinating their care in that decision on, are they appropriate for benzodiazepines? The big issue with benzodiazepines and opioids is I think 30 to 40% of overdose deaths, a benzodiazepine is involved. So, these are complex patients. And so really trying to avoid the use of benzodiazepines is the key, but I'm not aware of the FDA saying you can't do it, but you have to have that discussion of the risks and have a strategy for how you're going to get there. There have been a couple of questions, and I'll try to put these together about patients with endocrine effects from opioids. Kevin, can you comment about patients with low testosterone, let's say, from chronic opioid use? How would you approach that patient? We've had maybe three questions that similarly focus on endocrine abnormalities with opioids.
Yeah, absolutely. It's much more complex than the conversation that we have with patients around management of their pain. Many times the hormone suppression and some of the chronic changes that we see are part of not only the exposure to opioids, but also obesity and other factors that are part of their life. I think it creates an opportunity to have conversations around, the risk versus benefit. Is the benefit that we're seeing valuable enough to really weigh against the idea of continuing this medication that may be having some of these other adverse effects?
Okay. Neil, any comments from that?
No, thanks, Kevin. Go on to the next question. There are a lot of questions here.
Okay. This was good questions here. Do opioids have a place in pain management in any pain other than nociceptive types of pain?
Well, they we talked about that overlap that is so common. So if they didn't have any place other than nociceptive pain, we probably wouldn't use them as much when they've been overused. Clearly, and I hesitate to say they're good for nociceptive pain, we saw the relative benefit of opioids compared to NSAIDs, compared to NSAIDs plus acetaminophen. So I think the first response is that they actually just are not that great to begin with when we're talking about non-cancer pain. They are not the best choice. I won't say they have no place, or but they're not the best choice for neuropathic pain. And this, the new term that we're just, at least in primary care, becoming familiar with, the neuroplastic pain, is a type of neuropathic pain in many ways, central pain, what used to be called central pain. Clearly, the anti-epileptics, the SNRIs are better choices for those types of pain. So yes, opioids have their place in nociceptive pain. They're not the best choice there because of the risk of long-term addiction, and there are better choices for the other types of pain.
Yeah, and I think this brings up a good point. It's really hard because, you know, when you talk about an opioid analgesic, it affects analgesia, but it also has anxiolytic effects, reward effects. There's so many different things that can happen when a patient takes an opioid. And so it gets to be a challenge when we talk about, does it work for certain conditions or not? And I agree. I think, you know, the central sensitization, fibromyalgia, maybe not the best choice, but many patients are on those medicines because it helps with anxiety. There are some opioids that are approved for neuropathic pain. Some of the dual opioids that have a serotonin and norepinephrine effect and an mu receptor effect. So yeah, it's very complex. I think in the past, we thought this was mostly for nociceptive pain. There may be some patients with neuropathic pain and trying to avoid that with patients with central pain, or is it the opioid part of their other medications that you're taking? And Neil talked about more rational polypharmacy, using an anticonvulsant, the SNRIs, using different medicines. This another question came up, which I think is good because we've seen it maybe two or three different ways. Can you please talk a little more about initiating the conversation with patients that you want to taper? My team has hit some roadblocks. So maybe Kevin, first, if you can comment on some of the roadblocks you may have seen yourself in front of with regards to tapering a patient and how you got around that. And then we'll ask Neil for his comments.
Of course. I think there's a long list of roadblocks that we can all reference over time. I think my approach is pretty consistent, you know, especially with patients that you've known for a while. Is this medicine doing what we've employed it to do, essentially? What kinds of side effects are we seeing? If it's not working, if there are side effects, that makes a lot of sense to really talk about other opportunities for treatment. And if the medicine was originally initiated as a sole strategy for managing pain, really talking about those other modalities, those other multidisciplinary approaches to pain management. So that's the brief answer of how I approach it.
Neil?
I'll add, Kevin, great points. Boy, are there roadblocks. And I think that to me, the best initial approach is standing back and saying, let's clarify what our goals are, because I think we have the same goals here. And it's very hard to argue with goal setting. And the goals are almost always the same between clinician and patient. They're to maximize function, to address pain, and to minimize side effects. Once we establish those goals, then we can begin to brainstorm together. To use a fancy term, this is motivational interviewing. We can begin to brainstorm together about what are the best ways to meet those goals, and are there some things that might impede our ability to meet those goals? And as I said, when we talked about tapering isn't a great idea for everyone. It's a good idea for a lot of people. If someone's working, if their family life is good, if they've tried tapering previously and they didn't do well and they're not having cognitive dysfunction, they're doing fine. I wouldn't push it. On the other hand, if in any of those domains they're missing, let's see if it might be because of opioids. And I don't see these as discussions, particularly when we're hitting roadblocks, that are solved in one visit. But if I were to use a number of visits, 3 or 4 visits where we're discussing this again, we often make headway.
Yeah, and I would comment too, I think the whole tapering idea, I like to think, I'm a physiatrist and I'm a pain clinic, so our evaluations, we can get an hour to see patients, but I really focus on a good thorough physical exam because, you know, we pick up so many things on the physical exam and then talking about that and how we can address what we found on exam. Do they have myofascial pain? Do they have hip contracture? You know, those are the things we're going to focus on. And then start talking about, is the opioid appropriate? Are we going to start to taper? Or maybe to figure out the taper is going to be something on the second and third visit. And I've had many patients we've taken down maybe 30%, and then we've kept them at that level, or hold the taper for a couple months. And then over time, try to taper again. So this is a thing that can take many times months. In some patients on higher doses, it could take you over a year to taper a patient down or get them down to safer doses or transition them to buprenorphine, which unfortunately we didn't have any time to talk about buprenorphine and that efficacy in switching patients over. We have just 2 minutes, so I just wanted to comment, get this question out. We've had a couple here to Kevin. If you could answer this, someone had asked, how do you integrate behavioral health like hypnosis in your practice at the primary care level?
Absolutely. Well, I think the first piece of that is behavioral health. We include our behavioralists in our pain management team. We actually have a dedicated pain management clinic that is embedded within primary care. So that is a multidisciplinary team. We have a psychologist that is part of that group. I think a real trick here is understanding which of our patients have the comorbidities that include depression and anxiety and bipolar disorder, and really ensuring that not only are we having those conversations and trying to separate the pain a little bit from those other diagnoses, but also ensuring that we include our colleagues in that process. I might actually turn that question back to you as far as your experience as a pain specialist and who benefits most from hypnosis.
Well, we have a relaxation therapist in our clinic. So a lot of the patients just with anxiety, all of us could probably benefit from talking to a relaxation therapist and learning diaphragmatic breathing. So many of your patients could benefit from it as an additional tool. We do think it's important for patients to see a pain psychologist or a PsyD for an evaluation. So I think even in the community, having 2 or 3 good psychologists that are comfortable seeing chronic pain patients, because we probably underutilize cognitive behavioral therapy, mindfulness. There's a lot of apps. There's a lot of technology that patients can use after a very short 6 or 7 visits with a psychologist or a counselor that's trained. So relaxation training is just on the menu of what our psychologists do. A lot of physical therapists are trained in relaxation training and diaphragmatic breathing and biofeedback. There are physical therapists that are trained in what's called pain neuroscience education, and they teach patients about peripheral sensitization. They include how to do deep breathing while they're doing their physical therapy exercises. So you can actually find physical therapists that do some of the cognitive behavioral therapy work for you. And again, those therapists get the training in what's called pain neuroscience education or psychologically minded PT. So I think a lot of healthcare providers are kind of picking up skills from other types of disciplines, and maybe you could find those types of therapists in your community that can help you out as well. I really want to thank Kevin and Neil again. This has been a great discussion. Thanks to the audience for a number of questions. We probably could have spent 2 hours going through all the questions. We really appreciate that. We realize it's a very busy time for all of you, and we appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedule to join us today for this really important webinar. We hope you found some new tips and strategies and really get you thinking about this biopsychosocial approach for your patients and really providing better patient-centered care. On behalf of CME Outfitters, I just want to say thank you again to all of the healthcare teams for their dedication and commitment to really helping patients, especially during this very difficult time. So with that, really have a great day. Stay safe out there and really use those resources we talked about. Use those videos. We really hope this can be tools you can use you know, long term, even after this webinar is finished. So thanks again to Kevin and Neil. I really appreciate your time today.
Thank you.